The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, before we go to our guest today, Alan Newman, who I know you've been waiting to talk to for a long time on this program, we've got to talk about the interest rate cuts both in Europe and in China recently. I mean, what are they saying? Are they saying that stimulus is necessary?
Kevin, I think that's really the bottom line. It is that things are weaker than anyone is expecting them to be at this point in the quote-unquote recovery. And, in fact, further measures are needed. So it was very curious because you had a variety of central banks announcing things here recently, and it really surprised the market. But what didn't happen was any sort of recovery in the equities market, whether it be in Europe or in the United States. So you had the Bank of England, which announced their £50 billion monetization scheme. It really is quantitative easing for them. The ECB cut rates by 25 basis points, the overnight lending rate to zero, and then you have the People's Bank of China, which cut its key rate. That's twice in 1 month, and they haven't done any rate cuts since 2008, and now we get twice in 1 month. So the question of, are things really slowing in China? Yes, indeed. Are things still bad in Europe? Yes, indeed. Could we expect the same from the Fed later in the year? Again, our view is that it would be under duress, and we may get that in the equity markets between now and the end of the year.
Well, and David, you know, we've talked about trying to stimulate equities markets or try to bail out the banks, but what it really does is it penalizes the savers. I mean, what we're talking about in repression of the interest rate cycle, you know, look at Denmark. We're talking about insanity. We've had zero interest rate policies here in America, but what about NERP, negative interest rate policies?
Well, that's right. I mean, talk about penalizing the savers when it actually costs you to keep deposits at the local institution as a deposit. We're doing that in the United States. We're just doing it surreptitiously.
With inflation and not making real rates of return.
Exactly.
Right.
So you're at a negative real rate of return when you factor in inflation, but this is an actually stated negative interest rate policy. That says something as well. I think you've got two areas that we should focus on, you know, that were, again, recently the keys in my view. Retail sales fail in June.
Right. Again.
Yeah, and on top of that, you've got an employment number, which again, disappointed. We reiterated 8.2. The non-farm payrolls was a disappointment. Does it come as a surprise to us? No, it doesn't. I wouldn't put too much into the number, at least on the non-farm payrolls side, because again, you've got very positive factors on a seasonal basis, which get put in January,
sure,
February,
a lot of
March.
Short-term employment. I mean, these are temporary jobs we're talking about.
Right. And then you have extra negative seasonals this time of the year. So while it's bad, and I think it is bad,
right,
I wouldn't read too much into the number in terms of it being sort of an Armageddon-type number. But yeah, we look at 2012 as very similar to 2011, and we'll spend some time looking at the stock market today with Alan Newman. 2012 and the stock market in 2011, you're looking at a behavior pattern which is very, very similar. And so we would be cautious here in the summer months and coming into the fall, and maybe it's on a delayed basis. You certainly have political issues in the works, and do we have really anything to look at between now and November? I don't know. No one does. Or is it really the issues that come unglued in 2013? Again, I don't know. No one does. We certainly didn't see, in spite of coming into an election year last year, things hold together that well coming into the summer months. And we could certainly see the same sort of summer swoon, if you will, here in 2012.
Well, and David, there has been a decade change as well. You know, we're talking about the summer swoon. We're talking maybe about what's occurred over the 2012 period of time. But one of the things that I've really liked about Alan Newman's newsletter, and actually going back to the man who recommended him originally to you, was a guest of ours from Barron's Magazine, Alan Abelson. Okay, Alan Abelson can look at the last five, six, even almost seven decades and say, well, I've written about it. I've analyzed it. Alan Newman, in his Cross Currents, has said there has been a fundamental change. He's actually testified to the government on the fundamental change in the market as far as the amount of time that people are holding shares. Used to be people would buy a stock and they'd say, okay, we're going to hold this. We're even going to pass it down. Now, people right now are changing stock holdings completely in their portfolios in less than a month.
And that's what we suggested several weeks ago, Kevin, this change from an investor mentality to a speculator mentality. Now the Wall Street firms who are leading that charge, again, they think in terms of nanoseconds, not even weeks, months, or years, as investors would traditionally do. Well, summer months offer us the chance to reflect and sort of appraise the markets from a bird's eye view. And quite often, seasonal factors have markets languishing in the summer heat, so to say, with activity picking up in the autumn months as those cycle back around. We want to take an appraisal of the market today, and we've invited newsletter writer and market technical analyst Alan Newman to do just that with us. We're going to look at your perspective on a broad range of markets today, Alan. Let me just say at the outset, I highly recommend Mr. Newman's publication, Cross Currents. I think I first came across Alan's work through Alan Abelson, and have been a regular subscriber since then. And I just have to say, folks, honestly, he could charge five times the price. I'd still pay it. He's worth the reading, and I hope you consider doing so. Maybe towards the end of the comments today, you can tell us just about how the newsletter subscription would look for a new subscriber. You know, let's dive into the equities markets, because I think that's something that, again, there's a bit of a disconnect. We're sitting now close to 13,000 on the Dow. I was on CNBC yesterday, and the question was asked, have we turned a corner? And my suggestion was that we might have turned a corner to the downside, but I'm not sure what kind of a corner we could turn to the upside. Maybe you can give us some general comments, and then we'll get specifically into things like insider selling and some of the average holding periods, things that are substructural to the market, but very important.
Okay. First, let me say thank you for inviting me on. Very happy to be here. I think the jobs report today tells us a lot about turning the corner. We're not. It's kind of obvious we're not creating enough jobs to make up for even a population increase in this country. And I'm doing a report now for our next issue that's going to focus on the IPO market. I'm a strong believer in the capital formation system and that the equity markets is where we get a lot of our job creation from. And it's not happening. And it's not happening because it's no longer an investment market. It is a short-term trading market. As I've shown already in Cross Currents, the average holding period for stocks is down very, very sharply over the last 10, 15, 20 years. We're down to an average holding period for stocks that's somewhere along the about 3 months. I mean, for Apple, it's far less. For the S&P Spiders, it's 5 days. Who wants to invest in such an environment? It doesn't pay to invest. So if you have a market where it's just trading and not investment, it's very hard for companies to come to market, to bring their shares to the market in an initial public offering. And I'm going to be showing in charts, in very, very, very vivid pictures, how this has affected our economy and our job market. If you take a look at, you know, some of the big popular names like Google, they now have 33,000 employees, and they have it because they had a huge IPO. They were able to come to market. Apple's got over 60,000 employees. Microsoft has over 90,000 employees. In the overall picture, that doesn't really sound like a lot. You get to a company like Home Depot. They have 330,000 employees. How about Walmart? They came public too. 2.2 million employees. This is a big segment of our economy. And if you're not going to have IPOs, you can't possibly have the type of job creation that we used to have. And guess what? Over the last 10 to 15 years, IPOs have slowed sharply. We're talking about 80% down. Well, it's no wonder that the jobs market is the way it is.
We've actually seen a trend in the direction of privatization. Rather than going public, many managers, very skilled executives, have basically said, we know how to manage this business for a successful outcome over the next 3 to 5 to 10 years, and we're tired of being micromeasured on a quarter-by-quarter basis. Maybe it just makes sense to go private. Is that a part of that trend, you think?
I don't think you can raise as much money privately. I mean, the venture capitalists will generally be the first ones in an IPO or in an eventual IPO. I think there is more money to be made in that respect, but I don't think you can raise as much without the public. That's where all the money comes in. Look at Facebook. That's a big deal.
Well, looking at some of the things you've just mentioned, the jobs report, we also had retail figures come out here in the, retail sales fell short in June. And here's what I'm asking. In your recent report, you talked about retail companies and insider selling being on an increase. Do you see the connection there between the insiders at retail corporations liquidating their positions in companies that they manage and in which they have large share positions in this slowdown in retail sales?
Yes, absolutely. I noticed actually when this really hit home was at the bottom in 2009, because I took a look at the insider reports, and in the retail sector, insiders had cut down their selling so dramatically. My first thought was, wow, this is probably a bottom. It was the lowest I had ever seen, but that since expanded. And in 2011, I had two reports that were off the charts. And in January 2012, I had another one that was even worse. And it's a little better now. They're still selling a lot. It's not quite as bad as the two reports I did in 2011 or in January 2012. But I read that as seller exhaustion. They've just sold so many shares that they cut back a little on sales. But if insiders at retail companies are so that they lack the confidence to hold on to their shares or to buy shares, it tells us a lot about retail sales countrywide. They're just not going to be as good.
Well, and as you pointed out in the January report, insider selling was reaching peaks of 127-1. And very fairly, you netted out Microsoft's regular liquidations because
right.
Several families there are mass liquidators. But still, even netting out Microsoft, you were at 100-1 in terms of liquidations compared to purchases. This is an interesting sort of, again, it's a substructural current. And when I don't know if you've intentionally named your report cross currents, but I think of the undercurrents here in the marketplace, which sometimes show up in the technicals, in the charts, which you might not see in just fundamental analysis. You could speak to high frequency trading. Wall Street argues that it helps provide liquidity. And we sometimes wonder, I say this somewhat tongue in cheek, can we assume that this is another one of Wall Street's sort of benevolent functions?
It does not provide liquidity. That's, first of all, it's a lie. Secondly, if you see any days in which it does, it's really an illusion. If you want the perfect proof, you got to go back to the flash crash, which was not all that long ago, and it's going to happen again. There is no doubt it's going to happen again. Themis has done a number of reports.
Trading?
Yeah, that were very interesting, and they showed not long ago how there was actually one instance in which trading on Yahoo had advanced beyond the speed of light. I mean, this is ridiculous. This is the antithesis of an investment market. How can you have people invest when it's more important to trade at a millionth of a second?
Well, and doesn't that bring up the question of price discovery and the changes in market dynamics as trades are essentially moving off the exchanges and into black pools? Maybe you can expand a little bit on the function of a black pool and, again, sort of the impairment to the capital markets. Talked about the IPO markets earlier and that shrinking. It seems that black pools have a similar effect in terms of a negative impact.
Yes, they do, because you don't see all the bids and offers out there. Mutual fund is not going to see all the bids and offers out there. Maybe it doesn't matter for you and I. Maybe it doesn't matter for the average Joe from Idaho who wants to buy a couple of hundred shares or something, but it's certainly going to matter for mutual funds, and it's going to matter to the system insofar as investment is concerned if most trades are taking place on these extremely short time horizons. The valuation of the stocks that you're buying or selling are of no consequence. All you're trying to do is rip a penny out of the system. The penny has absolutely nothing to do with value. The algorithms that they come up with have absolutely nothing to do with value. If you're taking all the considerations of value out of the system, or you're cutting them to the quick, there can't be any real price discovery. There can't be any real consideration that I'm doing this for a good reason other than to grab a penny. And as those trades pile up, pricing is inefficient, and it is just growing more and more inefficient over time. And you can cite for me that the S&P price-earnings ratio is, moderate right now. I think it's meaningless because so much is traded without any consideration of value. I have seen the S&P price earnings ratio in the past fall to 8-1 or even down as low as 6-1. So if it's 14-1, that doesn't tell me that it's fairly priced. What tells me whether it's fairly priced or not currently is that very, very few shares that are traded are considering whether it's fairly priced or not. The only consideration is, of the moment, can I get a penny out of it?
What about rebates?
Well, that's another thing. You have a lot of firms out there that can essentially buy and sell at the same price and make money from the exchanges. If that is not the height of silliness, I don't know what is. And it can't possibly help the system. If you and I are out there trying to make a buck by investing and some high-frequency trading firm can buy and sell the shares that we're interested in at the exact same price and make money, it's like insider trading. Why don't I have that advantage?
Now, you in the past looked at sort of the public leaving the markets on the basis of some of the things that you're talking about. Probably just general discouragement over the last 10 years, starting with the Dow at roughly these levels and the Dow being at these levels 10 years on, very similar to that 1966 to 1982 period of just grinding sideways under 1,000. What do you see in terms of something restoring confidence and health to the capital markets? Are we talking about new regulatory regimes? I mean, I don't know that Dodd-Frank got very much done in terms of new regulation and them sort of cleaning up the mess that is today Wall Street. But what would you suggest is a healthy course towards restoring health to the capital markets?
A new regulatory regime would help. I mean, right now, the markets are pretty much controlled by the self-regulatory mechanisms, and it's like having the foxes and the hen out. You can't have the exchanges and the brokerage firms monitoring their own businesses because there were so many examples where they're not doing the job. The SEC, as far as I'm concerned, has been asleep at the switch for many years, and they have totally abandoned their mission statement, which is to protect us. Yeah, I think there's a lot that has to be done to bring back confidence for investors. And without a lot being done to bring back that confidence, the market is never going to get back to where it is. It's just going to remain fallow for us for years to come. It's going to be like that period from 66 to 82, and the way it's been for several years now, it's just going to continue in that mode.
Now, we've talked about just briefly, Dodd-Frank, and just a reference to it, there was supposed to be some legislation within that that dealt with derivatives and sort of controlling the derivatives market. Is derivatives a big issue, or is it the big issue?
You can make a very good case that it is the big issue. You're talking about an arena just for the U.S., and I'm not even talking worldwide. It's over $230 trillion in notional values. That's a lot of zeros. If you talk about worldwide, we're talking about $650 trillion. And, you know, for years I have been very, very agitated about the fact that this arena was growing so rapidly. We're talking about like 19% a year. Well, now it's not growing. Now it's kind of contracting very slowly, and I think that tells us more so that we have reached the point where we cannot cope with the sheer amount of contracts that are out there. There's too many contracts. There's too many counterparties. We have no idea how they interact. The perfect proof that there is a big problem is what we've seen in recent years. We saw it first actually in 1987 with the stock market crash with stock futures and portfolio insurance. We saw it to an even larger aspect in 1998. That's 11 years later. Long-term capital management nearly took down the world financial system. We were probably only hours away from total financial collapse. We saw it again in 2008 and 2009, so that's another 10 years. I think these episodes are going to come more quickly. And now that growth has slowed, it's actually starting to contract, and it's telling us that the system can't accommodate this daisy chain of contracts. It could get a lot more rapid.
We talked about high-frequency trading and the argument that Wall Street makes that it provides liquidity. The argument for derivatives is that it provides safety. I mean, you mentioned the 1987 period and the fact that derivatives were called portfolio insurance at that point. Now, derivatives, whether it's, you know, credit default swaps or what have you, are there to, quote-unquote, protect and eliminate or broadly diversify risk throughout the system. Hasn't it really been just the issue of increasing leverage within the financial community?
Yes, absolutely. It's another way for bean counters to show profits, profits that really aren't legitimately there. And you have all these huge banker bonuses, and that's one of the things that they're predicated on. We're dealing with very dangerous things here. If we can't account for every single way that these contracts interact, something is going to hit the fan sooner or later, and it's going to take us down. It's already done so a number of times. I think what you saw with MF Global was part of the problem. I think what you saw recently with JP Morgan was part of the problem. Insofar as derivatives being beneficial, Alan Greenspan, who was one of the greatest proponents and who, in my mind, will go down as the worst Fed governor of all time and the worst Fed chairman of all time, has already admitted he was wrong. I don't think you need to know much more.
Well, if there is this sort of looming issue with derivatives and counterparty risk, what, in your opinion, is a reasonable approach to insuring, not portfolio insurance as in via the derivatives market, but insuring against the kind of issues which can arise directly from the derivatives markets? Is there a way that an investor should be sort of insulating themselves from market vulnerability?
A way for investors to insulate themselves from market volatility?
Not so much volatility, but just systemic risk.
Well, you know, I've always told the big investors that I had to really do your own homework, and I think that advice has been paramount throughout the years. If you don't do your own homework, you're going to suffer in the final analysis. You have to sit down and read the newspaper every day. You have to be aware of the financial markets. You have to do some of your own research. You have to be very, very aware. That is the best way to insulate yourself from a potential downfall. Insofar as our authorities, I think they have to admit that we have serious problems going forward, and they're affecting the small investor, they're affecting larger investors, and we have to worry less about banks making money and more about banks making sure that business and the economy survive and prosper.
Well, Alan, whether it's the retail jobs report or the newest unemployment numbers out, we have some headwinds, and you're seeing those show up in the insider selling, the high-frequency trading, that substitution, if you will, for the man in the street. Now it's just Wall Street who's playing the game of investor. I hope that next week we can take a look at the metals markets, because I know that you've been keenly interested in precious metals going back to about 9/11. So the better part of 11, 12 years now, you've been looking at the metals markets with a positive prognosis, and you still have a very bullish outlook on gold, which you consider to be a super bull market. So let's pick up where we're leaving off today with your comments on precious metals this next week. Look forward to carrying on that conversation.
Thank you.
Well, you know, David, it's been fascinating listening to Alan on this program. I do want to hear what he has to say next week on the precious metals. But, you know, let's just look back at Europe just for a moment. Last week, they basically supposedly solved the problem. The Spanish interest rates dropped back down below 7. They kicked the can down the road. But it seems like every time they kick the can, they keep catching up with the can quicker.
Well, in fact, this time around, they caught the can before it even hit the ground. I mean, so yes, they intervened in the markets. They're going to spend another $100 billion. Spain should be fine. The 10-year treasury in Spain drops below 7, drops precipitously below 7.
Right.
And it's back above 7 already.
Yeah.
So literally, they used to spend $100 billion and it would buy them 6 months, and then it bought them 4 months, and it bought them 2 months. Now it's not even buying them 6 to 10 days. So we are seeing an acceleration factor in Europe. We're seeing an acceleration factor in China. Two rate cuts, Kevin, in less than a month. And again, that's after not having cut rates since 2008. There is an acceleration factor on the world scene. And from a macro perspective, we see more risk in the market than at any time than we've seen, again, going back to 2008. I think the conversation about metals, particularly as an insurance component in one's portfolio, will be particularly apropos. I'd like to do that this week, in fact, but we're out of time. So we're going to postpone, and we'll pick up the conversation with Alan next week, specifically on precious metals, next week, Wednesday.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Now, I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Alan Newman. Join us next week, and we'll have Alan back to talk about the precious metals market specifically. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.